This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and we're back once again with letters from Kayfabe. And as ever, I'm joined by that chap called Alan. How are you doing this week, Alan?
I'm absolutely brilliant, as always. Excited to get into the sack, as always, as well. Try and make these innuendos. We're doing quite a lot of them on Twitter as well. There's some quite lewdish comments going on about sacks and things on there. So we've also got JT on again this week, haven't we, Parv?
Wow, JT. Well, I mean, I do remember that another one of the head honchos there at PTBN says, once you get JT on, you won't be able to get rid of him. And here he is, JT Rosero. How you doing, JT?
Well, there's nothing I like more than taking my hands and wrapping it around that sack and just reaching deep down inside and pulling out a nice letter to talk about wrestling history. And who said that? Was it Chad?
No, it was Brad.
Brad? Oh, whatever. He's useless. All right.
Okay, well, let's hit the mailbag then.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Okay, so the first question out the sack this week is, Dear Alan and Parv, and JT, I really wanted to know about Akio Sato's return to the WWF and the Orient Express becoming a trio. And that's from I Am Andrew in Vancouver, British Columbia. And that's and he sent that in from Twitter. So I Am Andrew, Akio Sato. Memories of him, we'll start with you, JT.
I don't have many memories because he was so boring. Like he was really the most boring part of the Orient Express. I mean, Tanaka at least had a little bit of flair, you know? So I mean, when they came in, he seemed like the more stoic member of the team. He seemed older to me, just facially. So he seemed like the kind of elder statesman of the Orient Express. And it was very clear. And this is, you know, me as a 9 and 10 year old before knowing like the history of Bad Company and AWA, that, you know, when Kato came in and took over, the team improved greatly. So to me, Sato always seemed like the anchor of the Orient Express that was holding. Didn't really do much when he was around. It wasn't until he left that they elevated. And I don't remember much about him in general. And then I do remember him coming back, of course, later on for that one or two appearances. But and then eventually managing Hakushi too.
Yeah, I mean, much the same. I mean, he didn't wear a mask, did he? Kato was the one who wore the mask. Tanaka didn't wear one, and Saito didn't wear one, right?
Correct. Yeah, Saito was the one who looked like your dad with a beard. Just didn't kind of fit in, really. But the kind of how it came about was the whole kind of Orient Express was Mr. Fuji split up the Powers of Pain as he sold the contracts to Slick, if you remember, who then got Bobby Heenan. It was involved with that as well between those two. So then Fuji really had nothing to do with tag teams. So he brought in the Orient Express as his latest threat to the WWF tag team division because they were supposed to represent Japan, even though Tanaka was born in Hawaii. And just to allude to the first question there from I Am Andrew, he says that Sato returned to the WWF. So he didn't return at first. This was his first run. He may have thought that he came back after a bit, which is true because it was a three-man team, but Sato was the first guy to hit a sit-out powerbomb in the WWF. There was powerbombs before. I think Judy Martin did one and some other guys, but he was the first one to sit a sit-down one, I'm led to believe from the research. So he went away, and the reason he went away was because he went to the WWF. Vince came to him and actually said, SWS is a promotion in Japan, and we want to have someone who would be an intermediary between the two groups, because Sato had lived in the US for years and years. He'd worked in the Amarillo territory, I think, and he met his wife there. I think it was Amarillo, I could be wrong. But yeah, he was fluent in English, so he was someone that could have been a go-between. So he did some talent exchanges, the SWS, and we've touched on that before. So we had Tenryu and Katao over for WrestleMania 7, and The Rock as Warlord, Snooker, Haku, and did SWS tours the other way. So he was kind of intermediary there. And I think an interesting thing was, he went away, they didn't really mention it apart from he went back to Japan, and they brought Kato in, who was Paul Diamond under a hood. And do you guys think that Bad Company would have been a better fit, and they should have got rid of the Orient Express altogether?
Oh, I mean, yes, because if anybody's watched Bad Company, Tanaka is just so cool. There's something about him in that, like, he's just a cool-looking dude. And that is lost when you put him with, you know...
His dad.
His dad, basically, and have Mr. Fuji with the cane and all of that. It's just, like, all sense of what made those guys cool is lost. Diamond, I mean, in my mind, I'll probably get heat for this, but in my mind, he's, you know, jobber-level talent. But Tanaka, really good wrestler. In fact, they could have just brought him in as a singles, maybe. Like, he could have done something. I could even see, like, a team with, like, this is going to sound really weird to some people, but, like, Pat Tanaka and Razor Ramon could have been cool in 1992, for example. So that's my V1 thing. I think Tanaka is the ace in that kind of, in the Orient Express, basically. I mean, Saito, he was kind of like an All Japan undercard guy a lot of the time. You know, like, they had, like, the main tag titles and then, like, the shit kind of middle tag titles that you don't see that much. Saito seemed to be in that scene a lot, from what I can remember of the 80s. So, yeah. What was the match that they actually had, JT? They did have one team, a triple six-man team. Was it SummerSlam Spectacular? Is that the one?
Yeah, and just one aside on the Bad Company thing, too. I think if they did it at first, it could have worked. I think if they tried to do it after Sato left and when Diamond came in, it would have bombed because we had already seen a year's worth of Tanaka not being like that. So I think it was all or nothing with Bad Company. Either you had to do it out of the gate or it was too late.
Well, the other
and
point
I still don't know why they didn't bring in Paul Diamond. I don't get why they didn't just do it.
Well, I think the reason why they didn't do it afterwards as well was because Paul Diamond had been jobbing on TV for right. You know, a better part of 1990. So they had to put him under a mask to make him believable as some sort of threat because they'd just seen him, you know, job on TV. So they did have that match, though, didn't they? Like you said, it was on the SummerSlam Spectacular. It was Steamboat, Davey Boy, and Von Erich. Kerry Von Erich against the three-man Orient Express. So... that was the only kind of thing I remember.
It comes out of nowhere, too. It's like he's just there. Like, they just say, okay, we're fighting the Orient Express. Okay, well, is Fuji fighting or what's going on? And then there's Sato. You know, it was so random. And it was a warm-up match for those faces for SummerSlam.
Vince does mention on commentary, the three-man version of the Orient Express. but, yeah, that's the only time we ever see them, I believe. But how stacked does that babyface side look? You know, Texas Tornado, British Bulldog, and Steamboat. Bang.
Those are great. It's gonna and the match at SummerSlam with Power and Glory and Warlord was pretty good too. Like that was it was cool how they were kind of doing the trios thing. Like I wish they kind of did more of it, that they kept the Orient Express around and made some more of these teams. Like Power and Glory and Warlord was a pretty fun team. And I don't get what I don't understand the decision to use Sato. Like why not throw literally anyone with the Orient Express? Like they had done it for years, like Brooklyn Brawler with them. Like they and you guys talked about in an early episode where they would mix up these teams of, you know, kind of a lower card guy and a jobber. Like there were a million people hanging around. It was such an odd decision for one night to go to the three Orient Express like out of nowhere. So that, I feel like there had to be something more to it. Like maybe they were going to do it more and then Sato just didn't want to keep wrestling, or I feel like there had to be a reason.
Yeah, I think that was the reason really, because he was his body would be beginning to break down at this point. He was been in the business 20 years. He was 37, so he wasn't, you know, really old. He looked older than that, though, to be fair, because we're referring to him as he looked like a dad. But yeah, he was only 37 at the time. But yeah, he'd been wrestling since he's 17. Had a wife in the US. You know, people get tired of the travel, and that was the reason, I think, for him.
Let's move on. I think that's the most anybody's ever talked about Saito ever. I'm actually surprised that Mr. Fuji didn't want to don the tights again. Usually you can't stop him getting in the ring. So.
I know, right? I was surprised they didn't actually just do that here.
So let's go back into the sack then. So, dear Alan and Parv and JT, what are your thoughts on the on-off Jannetty versus Michaels feud and the title change on Raw? And that's from Lee Malone in Meath Island, and Lee sent that in from Twitter. So, the title change on Raw was quite an interesting episode of Raw in general. It's probably one of my favourite WWF TV episodes of all time because we had this title change on there, but we also had the 1-2-3 Kid and Razor Ramon stuff as well, didn't we?
That's right. Well, JT, do you want to talk to this? You're kind of like a real expert on this era, I feel. So why don't you tell us a bit about the Michaels Jannetty feud?
Yeah, sure. And like I said, I just rewatched them all for PlayStation.com. We're in our ebook, free ebook. We're watching all these Raws. So I saw the whole thing kind of unfold. So Jannetty, He gets thrown through the barbershop window. I believe it aired very early in 1992, like the first week of January. Goes through the window, and then he's gone. Shawn Michaels has a long heel run, wins the Intercontinental title, and then Jannetty pops back up in the fall of 92. So he had really just been forgotten, an afterthought. He had been fired, so you know they don't have any match at the Rumble. They don't fight at WrestleMania 8, which was originally rumored to be the match they were going to have. Jannetty, you know, gets chick-canned. He comes back in the fall. Hits Sherry with a mirror when Shawn pulls her in front. And then we get the whole thing at the Rumble. So Jannetty goes to the Rumble. Sherry's now in his corner. And he loses there. And then he gets fired again. So now we don't get any further blow-off. Shawn just moves along. And then on May 17th, 1993, is a really big episode of Raw. After kind of a forgettable run over the past few weeks leading up to that. May sweeps maybe is the reason. I'm not sure. But we have the 1-2-3 Kid upsets Razor Ramon, and then in the beginning of the episode, Shawn Michaels comes out to brag that no one can beat him. He had beaten Jim Duggan the week before in a lumberjack match, and he had no competition left, and someone comes out of the crowd wearing a hoodie and a hat, and it's Marty Jannetty. And he basically, him and Vince, back Michaels into a corner, said, Michaels, hey, you said right here you would face anyone anytime, and I'm someone, and I'm here. And he's like, well, you don't have your gear. And he's like, I got my gear. I can fight. You know, I happen to bring it. So they make the match. Mr. Perfect comes out, throws the towel in Michael's face, and Jannetty wins the title. It's an awesome moment and a great match. And then they would have Michaels win the belt back at a house show when Diesel debuts. And then they had a rematch in July that was really, really good, too. And that's the match that won PWI Match of the Year from 1993, which I wouldn't put it that high, but it was really good. That was kind of their feud on TV for 93. And they would always go at it. They'd have, you know, be involved in tags here and there or in the Rumble. Like I said a couple weeks ago, they went at it in 94. So they always kind of crossed paths. But that was really the big moment of the feud, was that May 93 match.
I mean, my sense of this as a kid growing up was always that, like, do you remember after Strike Force split up and Tito was just kind of like still going off the fumes of that years later? Like, whenever he'd see Rick Martel, he'd be, like, chasing after him in the Rumble, or... Do you know what I mean? Like, he was just still feeding off the scraps of it. Or, like, we've seen with Virgil on this show, Alan. You know, years later, Virgil still only really got Ted to go off of, you know? Is there not some of that with Jannetty? It's like, the Michaels thing is the only thing he's got. Sure. Like, you know, he's still in the Rockers gear in 1994. You know,
he's still in the 96. Rockers gear in 96, yeah.
I mean, does he have anything else going on at all, Jannetty? Like, did he ever have another feud or another story, or was he basically?
Well, he won the tag titles, didn't he, as well? So he had that, you know. Was it him and 1-2-3 Kid?
Yeah, that was the other big feud that I had forgotten about, kind of. With him and Kid feuding with Johnny Polo and the Quebecers, it actually started in the fall. And Polo said, you know, either he could beat Kid or Jannetty with one arm tied behind his back. And then Kid and Jannetty had a match and Polo got involved. And then Jannetty ends up fighting Polo on Raw and Polo beat. It was like, it was this long, long feud that led to the Quebecers losing the titles to Kid and Jannetty in January. So, yeah, Jannetty actually was involved in more than I thought in that run. I thought he was just there purely as like a jobber to the stars. But he had this ongoing battle with Johnny Polo throughout the winter.
Now, here's a question for you. 1994, let's say the middle of 94, you can have Jannetty or you can have Virgil in your opener. Who do you take? Who's higher? Who's higher on the card? That's my question.
Oh, Jannetty, easily.
Jannetty always higher than Virgil, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say so as well.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, I think Jannetty, as he kept getting fired for drug use, so Virgil was around just by default. I think they would have probably kept Jannetty around, as they always seem to have a soft spot for him. They'd bring him back constantly because he comes back in late 95 after he leaves in early 94. So anytime he seemed to get cleaned up a bit and they needed a hand, they'd bring him in, and he would, you know, 95, he kind of resumes that jobber to the stars role, but with some big feuds, like he teams with Razor Ramon a lot. They're paired up as buddies, and then he turns heel and goes with the New Rockers, so...
Ah, but then he turns up in 2004 as well, if you remember. He has he has a match on Raw then. But yeah, he's still working to this day, and bless him, he had an incident at the WrestleMania weekend where he was found in a fountain in a hotel. Marty Jannetty, someone who should have done more than he did, and yeah, I really enjoyed him as a worker whenever he was around. It was never bad. It was always entertaining. But on that match that you were mentioning, JT, the one with Marty and Sean, where the title change was, Randy Savage on commentary had the line of the night. He basically said that Marty Jannetty on Ico Pro, no doubt, which was kind of quite funny considering he'd just come back from drugs and things like that. So trying to allude to drugs, but also tie into the Ico Pro the WWF were pushing at the time. So yeah, he was, you know, was always 5 minutes away from a disaster, was Marty Jannetty.
I mean,
he had a really good match too with Bam Bam Bigelow in his IC title defense. I think it was like the next week after he won it. That was a really good match too. And Doink, he had a great series with Doink over the summer in Raw.
Do you remember we talked about who had the greatest fall ever? Who did we talk about, Alan? Was it Ron Garvin or? There was somebody who was like...
Oh, it was it was Ron Garvin, because in the end he was teaming with Jobber against the Euro Express.
So from the Greg Valentine Royal Rumble win to what he was doing at the end of the year was like really sad, wasn't it? Well, looking at Marty Jannetty, he goes from being the Intercontinental Champion to literally jobbing to Bastion Booger and IRS and Johnny Polo.
And Borg on SummerSlam.
And Borger and Crush. And Owen Hart, and you know, he has that's a pretty steep drop from him in 1993, isn't it? From the IC title to, I mean, Bastion Booger was like a real bottom feeder of the card, and to be losing to him is really surprising, I think. So,
yeah, I would still go with Ron Garvin, he's still the lowest of the low. I mean, as well, he was world champion 3 years removed from 90, so doing jobs in a tag team with a jobber versus your Express 3 years later is a bigger decline. But yeah, Marty was also in that group of people I would consider.
All right, well, time for one more, I think.
Yeah, we'll go for one more here. And it's Dear Alan and Parv and JT, can you discuss the rise and fall of Zeus from No Holds Barred and SummerSlam Monsters to Survivor Series Afterthought? And that's from Timothesis. Is it Timothesis? I'm not pronouncing it.
Timothesis, Timotheus, maybe?
Timotheus, there we go, on Twitter. So thanks for helping me out with that one, Parv. So, Zeus. What are your memories of Zeus then, JT? This would have been 1989.
Yeah, so it was right, kind of right before I started watching, but I do have vague memories of him, like, live at the time, because I remember my cousin whining to me, and I really didn't know much about wrestling, but I remember whining that wrestling was turning into chair fighting. And looking back, I think he's talking about the Science Man event where they just keep pelting Zeus with chair shots. But so he was in the periphery of my mind, and then I learned more about him as I immediately caught up. And yeah, his drop off, you can tell Vince losing interest with him as it goes along, because he comes in with the hype off of No Holds Barred, and he gets that, you know, involved in that awesome cage match between Hogan and Boss Man at Saturday Night's Main Event. And the build up to SummerSlam, I mean, he's built up like a real monster, like, and that Savage had found this gold mine of this crazy man. And then, you know, he loses there, and did he get pinned? Do you guys remember? I know he gets hit with the purse. I feel like he took the pin in that match, which I don't know if you can confirm that or I can look it up, but it was, surprising to me that they made him eat the pin without waiting to do some kind of singles match. I mean, the story you always hear is that, you know, I don't know if it's true or not, but they wanted to run Hogan and Zeus at WrestleMania with six. So if that's the case, why do you have Hogan beat him in any way? Yeah, Hogan pinned Zeus with a slam and leg drop. So it's like, why do you have him eat the pin here unless you're going to blow the whole thing off? And then, so you figure, all right, well, maybe this is it. But no, and then he's back at Survivor Series where DiBiase uses him, and that whole Survivor Series is a whole nother story for another day, because they the teams are all mismatched with different guys that weren't really feuding, and they're all over the place. And then you get the match, the movie, which I'm sure we'll get to. But yeah, it was a weird run for Zeus. You could see him falling out of favor in Vince's eyes as it went along.
Yeah, I think Zeus really is underplayed about how successful he was during this run. I mean, SummerSlam 89, I mean, on pay-per-view, it did 625,000 buys. So it did more buys than WrestleMania that year. So, and it was one of the larger non-WrestleMania pay-per-views ever. So that did awesome numbers. And then we had Survivor Series 89 did 385,000 buys, which was quite a strong number for the pay-per-view concept at the time, because Survivor Series was not always successful as a pay-per-view. And then after that as well was we had that unique kind of no holds barred come match with him and Savage versus Hogan and Beefcake again, kind of blow off cage match that, you know, did real strong numbers as well. I believe that he got 255,000 buys on pay-per-view, even with the discounted rate of 14.95. That I think is a huge number because the viewing of the movie had been out in theaters 6 months prior to this, mm-hmm. and the match itself wasn't live at the time. I don't know if that mattered. It was taped 2 weeks earlier on December the 12th, 89. So all in all, Zeus in his three main event matches with different partners drew a combined 1.26 million buys, which is really a big number if you think about it. So from a business point of view, that kind of verifies how successful Zeus was as a gimmick. And I could see why Vince kept using him after SummerSlam. So it might have been he got the big buy rate for SummerSlam and Vince thought, hang on a minute, I'm going to use him again. And that's why he was used again at Survivor Series with Ted.
What's interesting to me is that, as far as I know, those are the only three matches Zeus had, right? Apart from, I mean, he has a couple of shots a little bit later on, which we'll get to. But that must make him in, like, the top percent. If you, I don't know what the metric would be, like, matches to drawing ratio or something. But he must have right. a pretty decent hit rate, right?
No, I think you're right because I mean that research was brought up on by Matt Farmer, the kind of stuff I've read out there. One of the historians who's online and does some good work out there with research. So that from him is a great point that how much great business he did, and I think success of how many shows he had versus the business. He wasn't classed as a celebrity though, was he? He was classed as a wrestler. You know, right. like some guys come in and do one match like a Lawrence Taylor or something. He wasn't classed as a actor. At all, he was classed as this madman. So
that's kind of what made it weird because they acted like he was out of the movie and he was still trying to kill Hulk Hogan. You know what I mean? Like, so they acted like this. It was like
Zeus. The movie was a shoot.
Right? Yeah, like Zeus in the movie was actually Zeus. It wasn't an actor playing Zeus. It was that like this guy Zeus was in the movie and he's pissed off about how the movie went down, so he showed up here to still go after Hogan. So that was what was weird about it. They didn't bring it like it was a celebrity coming in. It was just this madman that was cast in the movie, but he's still really crazy.
And so, I mean, just to finish up on what else Zeus did in his career in wrestling, he crops up in Puerto Rico in 1990 against Abdullah the Butcher, and he beats him by countout. Of course, Abby never drops a pinfall. I wonder that probably did a decent gate as well, I'd imagine, that Puerto Rican thing, because they draw pretty well there, even in 1990. And then he doesn't step into the ring again until the infamous Doomsday Cage match in WCW. This is in 96, where it's, Hogan and Savage, the mega powers, against the Alliance to End Hulkamania, where there's about eight different guys in the cage, including, of course, the Ultimate Solution and the Gangster. So
why did they dig him up for this? It's so random. It's not like he owed Hogan a win. You know, a lot of times Hogan would bring guys into WCW to get his win back. He had beaten him twice. So it was kind of weird that they dug him out, unless he was just hard up and whatever. Hogan was his buddy and he brought him in. But the whole thing was weird.
I think it was the idea of like all of these villains from
Hulk's
past or whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of like who was the Ultimate Solution anyway? Like, Doesn't matter. We couldn't have. And then randomly, he also cropped up this year. Did this get a lot of talk on the internet, Alan? He had two matches for All Japan, where he defeated a wrestler called Sushi.
No. That's not the same Zeus.
That's not Zeus.
No, you're going to get...
I was going to say, that's pretty amazing.
No, I wish he was. That's a different Zeus. He was actually a really good worker, Parv. You should check him out. And you're probably going to get moaned at now on the PWO.
No. Somebody needs to tell Cage Match because they have this Zeus as having wrestled those matches, which is why I thought it was like, what? So there we go.
Solution was Jeep Swenson, right? And then he ended up dying. Wasn't he Bane as well in Batman?
That was huge.
Somebody needs to get in touch with the Cage Match guy and tell him that is not the same Zeus.
Right. I will DM Strigger and have words with him.
Zeus was also in a Sublime music video for Santeria, if you remember. That was his big
one. I like that song, but I don't remember him in the video. Cool.
Yeah, he's in the video.
Let us go now over to JT Rosero for this week's Event Center.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Parf. Thank you, Alan. And thank you, Justin. Anyway, JT Rosera here with your letters from Kayfabe Event Center. And happy Thanksgiving to everyone over in the United States. Hope everyone's having a great time, enjoying some turkey and some football. And maybe some wrestling somewhere along the way. Of course, wrestling always steeped with great tradition when it came to Thanksgiving week and Thanksgiving Eve and Thanksgiving night. And none more than the Survivor Series, of course, for many, many years, took place on Thanksgiving night, eventually the Thanksgiving Eve, and now generally the Sunday before Thanksgiving. But I want to take you back all the way to 1989, November 23rd, Survivor Series 1989 from Chicago, Illinois. Featured a very interesting card, one that you could argue maybe could have been shaken up a little bit differently. Of course, we had Dusty Rhodes, Brutus Beefcake, Tito Santana, the Red Rooster, defeating the Big Boss Man, the Honky Tonk Man, Bad News Brown, and Rick Martel in the opener. And Bad News Brown subbing for Akeem, just like back in 1990 when those reports never came. Akeem mysteriously disappears from this show. Bad News Brown took his place, but for the second straight year, walked out on his team, who saw it coming. Of course, the loner keeps getting asked back, and there's really no excuse for some of these guys who have seen his actions in previous matches like this and keep trusting him for it. Backfires every time. In the next match, Macho King employed the services of Dino Bravo, Greg Valentine, and Earthquake to defeat Jim Duggan, Bret Hart, Ronnie Garvin, and Hercules. Of course, that was Earthquake's pay-per-view debut after he debuted earlier in the fall on television, and he, Savage, and Bravo all survived that match. Hulk Hogan, Jake Roberts, and Demolition defeated Ted DiBiase, the Powers of Pain, and Zeus. And that was a very controversial match where the referee bailed Hogan out multiple times, disqualifying both Zeus and the Powers of Pain. And then we have our next match where Mr. Perfect, Rick Rude, and the Rougeau brothers defeated Roddy Piper, Jimmy Snuka, and the Bushwhackers. Mr. Perfect was the sole survivor there. And in our main event, the Ultimate Warrior, Jim Neidhart, and the Rockers defeated Andre the Giant, Haku, and Arn Anderson, and Bobby Heenan subbing for Tully Blanchard, who had been fired right before the show. Arn Anderson would leave the show, leave the promotion as well, after the show, I should say. They would both return to WCW, perhaps? No, Arn Anderson did, but Tully Blanchard, his news circulated that he was fired due to a drug issue and a drug suspension. WCW had no part of him, and he was not brought back to be part of the Horsemen in 1990. So Arn Anderson returns to WCW there. I always thought this card could have been shaken up a little bit differently, especially when it comes to Randy Savage not being part of the Hogan and Zeus situation. You have DiBiase shoehorned in there and a couple other spots where things could have been mixed up. But overall, pretty fun show, especially for nostalgia and especially for that opening bit where everyone says what they're thankful for. Of course, one of the most memorable and endearing moments of the Federation years. And of course, when it comes to Survivor Series, we're all very thankful for elimination matches. And we're actually going to get some of those this year, believe it or not. So for myself, I'm out. And I guess back to myself and back to Parv and Alan and JT or Justin, someone, everyone. Have a great Thanksgiving. Take care.
All right. Well, thank you very much, JT. And JT,
no problem.
You're still with us.
I am.
Interesting. So, Alan, I think we've got time for a longer topic now.
Yes, the longer topic is we're going to return from a topic we covered in a previous show. Correct me if I'm wrong, was it episode 9?
Episode 9, that was right.
Yep. So we're covering the kind of maneuverings and decisions of Jack Tunney. So this is part 2 now. So part 1 we ended with the Bobby Heenan, Jack Tunney, and firing Rick Rude, ridiculous, stupid, daft, you know, ruling. So we'll move on from there now. So the next kind of major thing that he was involved with was the tag title change that wasn't to be in October 30th, 1990, where Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty beat Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart in a best of two out of three falls match to win the titles. So what actually happened in this match was the ropes broke in the second fall when Hart tried to go for the heart attack. He couldn't do it. The ropes broke just before that. It looked a bit ridiculous. The match continued. Jannetty pinned Neidhart in the third fall after Michaels prevented the heart attack. And then Jannetty fell on Neidhart for the win. After the bell, after the match, they shook hands with the new champions raised. So, but what they decided to do, it was never mentioned on TV after this. And I think that was due to the rope breaks, and it didn't, you know, look that great. So it wasn't mentioned on TV apart from Jack Tunney officially reversing the decision of the match on TV stations in the immediate area. So that was to kind of tie in with the house show. So they wouldn't do that sort of thing anymore. They wouldn't care. But, you know, even then, they would kind of try and save the markets a little bit and make things make sense. So, you know, well done to the WWF for kind of doing that. A clip of the finish in the third fall were eventually shown in 1995 prior to Marty Jannetty's return to the WWF. So that was his decision there. And after that, moving into 1991, he was involved with David Roy Smith pinned Joe Turner with a running power slam. And during the bout, Vince McMahon announced that WWF president Jack Tunney was considering implementing an instant replay rule in the WWF that was a result of the main event of the Royal Rumble that year. So two things. We'll just go back to the first thing we mentioned there. What memories, JT, do you have of the match there with the 2 out of 3 falls? You probably wouldn't have heard of it like amongst people till, you know, years later.
Yeah, I definitely hadn't heard of it until years later, but I feel like it cropped up in some magazine, maybe like of the After Mag somewhere. Like, I feel like I knew of like this controversial thing that happened, but years later, of course, it was revealed that the only reason they ended up reversing it was that they were going to fire Jim Neidhart, and they ended up keeping him around. And so once they decided to keep him around, they decided to keep the belts on the Harts. So they used the rope breaking as a kind of as an explanation as to why they could put the titles back in the Hart Foundation. So I am curious if they didn't decide to rehire Neidhart, if they just would have let it go and just said the Rockers won the titles. Also, Jack Tunney was an idiot because he should have just let it stand. the rope breaking didn't matter.
So, Parv, with that, I mean, that was interesting that they were considering putting the belts on the Rockers in 1990 and then they didn't go ahead and do it later on. Do you think there's any reason why that was?
I don't know, like, just in my mind, even remembering being a fan back then, I just thought they were a bit small for WWF land. And, I couldn't really see them holding the tag titles, which is going to sound, you know, I guess retroactively they seem a bigger deal than they were because of, you know, Sean and, you know, they were a really good working team and so on. But I always remember them being lower down on the card and didn't think they'd really be in the running.
And do you think that's a fair decision by Jack Tunney then? Just because the ropes broke, that the decision should have been reversed. I think all's fair in love and war, and they won the titles. Brett and Neidhart didn't walk out. They continued the match. So I think the decision should have stood. So I don't agree with Jack Tunney there. You guys, you think the decision was right?
No, it was a pure power play. I think it got greased. I mean, why? All of a sudden, you have all these other title changes under all these other wild circumstances interfering. I mean, if you start overturning everything, where do you end? So, yeah, no, I don't. Okay, the rope broke. Could you still wrestle in the ring? Yes. You know, unless the arena's on fire and the match gets called. That's it, man. Final, the referee's decision's final. If the referee didn't call it off at the time, then forget it.
I think by this point, Tunney was so secure in his position, he thought he could do anything.
A power madman. So he was getting a bit of money, I think, a bit cocky. He bought some instant replay technology, or made it an instant replay rule anyway. So that was quite interesting, and that was a result of the main event of the Royal Rumble in 91. I can understand that with instant replays elsewhere, but what was the kind of thing in 91 at the Rumble that was required an instant replay?
It was Randy Savage costing Ultimate Warrior the world title match against Sergeant Slaughter.
So that I thought they meant the main event being the Royal Rumble match itself. So no, you're right there. So moving on then. So in September 91, we had Randy Savage, who was going to be meeting, it was announced on TV, with President Jack Tunney to try and get reinstated as a wrestler. So Randy Savage at this point, he'd retired at WrestleMania 7. He lost the match to Ultimate Warrior. And at this point, he wanted to come back. So he was kind of petitioning for that. So he went on this quest to kind of get his role back and pitch it to Jack Tunney. So the week later, on the show hosted by Vince and Roddy Piper, the show included an announcement that WWF president Jack Tunney had refused reinstatement of Randy Savage as a wrestler, and that Savage at this point had trashed Jack Tunney's office after hearing the news. You know, wow, you know, Randy Savage getting a bit hot under the collar there. Do you think, you know, it was fair of Jack Tunney to stick by the retirement rule from WrestleMania? And I will start. What do you think, JT?
Yeah, I mean, Savage agreed to it. Like, and we're not even how many weeks later. And I know he was, you know, pissed off about what happened at the wedding. But, you know, you agreed to the contract. So you can petition, you can ask, but you can't flip out on Tunney for him standing by what you signed. I mean, that's a binding contract. I think I'm with Jack on this one. Now, you can say, well, sometimes you got to do what's best for business. So you got to weigh the options, right? Do you want to come off as a soft president that's only about the business results, or do you want to stand by the contracts you're signing? Because you could say Savage is good for business. It's worth it.
So after this, because of trashing the office, he was he joined commentary a week later on TV, and he spoke about being put on probation for 90 days for trashing the office. So Jack Tunney didn't take too kindly at all, and dished out, you know, a suitable punishment for Savage there. Do you think that's fair on Savage, that he was given probation, Parv?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think he's lucky to have anything at all after trashing the president's office. I mean,
well, he's a former champion, though. You know, you got to give him that.
Yeah, I can't really. I think Savage is basically in the wrong in all of these things. I mean, he lost the retirement match fair and square. He's trashed the president's office. I have to say that, you know, after having a dodgy start to the year, Jack has done, you know, he's bringing it back. He's standing his ground. I agree with all of these decisions he's making on the Savage.
Well, he's definitely standing his ground, because he's not mentioned again on TV for three more weeks, and then Savage then announces he's going to have then the next week a second meeting with President Jack Tunney, and then the results would be announced on the next week's show. So what actually happened was next week on TV, Randy Savage was a guest on the Funeral Parlour, where he said he wanted to repay Sid Justice for helping him at his Reading reception by being Sid's replacement at the Survivor Series. Savage then said he wanted to be reinstated by WWF President Jack Tunney more than anything else in his life. So Sid at this point, you know, buddies with Savage, helping him out there, so he wanted to, you know, do him a favor, and he wanted to be back more than anything in his life. So he's pretty much begging here to bend over, help Sid do something for WWF, and also this really meant something to him. So he's trying everything at this point, isn't he, Parv, to try and get back in and get reinstated.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just how much wrestling means to Randy Savage. But maybe he should have thought that before he signed the contract. Mm-hmm. You know, I still don't really see how he's got a leg to stand on here. What happens? Does Tunney actually give way in the end?
Well, yeah, what happens is Tunney, he takes the matter under advisement at first, so he, you know, considers it. And then, well, I think what swings it is we get another appearance of Miss Elizabeth speaking from backstage on the 23rd of November 91 show, where she hoped that WWF President Jack Tunney would reinstate Randy Savage. And then on the 17th of November, Gene Oakland conducted an interview with Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth, with Savage saying he would be confident that Jack Tunney would reinstate him in time for Survivor Series, so that he could replace Sid Justice, with Savage getting the crowd to chant "reinstate, reinstate," featuring closing moments from Jerry Sags as well, and Jim Duggan, regarding other things. But yeah, it was quite interesting that he was trying to get the crowd here to kind of chant for him as well, to try and get Jack Tunney to give in to peer pressure. So JT, do you think Tunney, this is enough to make him crack, or do you think in hindsight Savage should have worked harder and, you know, proved more that he was willing to, or, you know, be deserving of getting back in with the wrestler's contract?
I think if I were Tunney, I'd be pissed. I mean, this guy, he signed the contract, and then he offered the appeal. That was turned down. And now he's, like, being really underhanded about it. Oh, you know, I really want to help Sid. No, you just want to get back into action. Like, he's using all these things. He's running his wife out there to you know, campaign. It's, I don't know. It just seems very whiny for Savage. Like, Savage never came off like a whiner like this. This was very, I'm still with Tunney on this one. I think, you know, he's bound to the contract. You know, Tunney reviewed it. And sorry, I know the fans are rooting for you, but sometimes you can't always kowtow to the fans. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Savage. Go to WCW.
Tunney is not he's not a populist president. He just sticks by the law, the rule of law.
That's it.
Well, I think that the one thing that sways things then was the incident with Jake Snake Roberts and the Snake, wasn't it? The biting of Randy Savage.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually got back in, and he made his wrestling return would be the Tuesday in Texas. Did he have the match at Survivor Series? Is that what reinstated him? Did he?
No, they announced it as Survivor Series that he's been reinstated, but they use it just to sell Tuesday in Texas. So they say he'll be in the ring Tuesday in Texas, and then they make the Tunney pulled the Jake out of the Survivor Series match as punishment. Because they thought they were going to have a 4-on-3 advantage. If you watch the Survivor Series Showdown, they're very confident that it'll be 4-on-3.
It's a very weird match, that. Is that the one where it's basically just like IRS versus Legion of Doom on his own?
No, it's IRS and the Disasters versus Legion of Doom. They walk out.
The Disasters bail on him. It's really weird, that match. Because doesn't it go on last as well? So it feels like it's a very strange, very strange card, that Survivor Series. Anyway, carry on. I don't see why the snake biting him changes anything, but there we go.
Well, it was definitely for Tunney. That was the thing that swayed him. He wanted him to get his revenge. So he's fair there. I mean, if someone gets bitten by a snake, you want to give him the chance to get the retribution inside the squared circle. Never mind, I would have gone and pressed charges personally, but there we go.
They could have done like, you know, if you look back through Tunney's history now, Savage have really studied the way to do it. You got to push Jake into going to Tunney to ask him to be reinstated, right? That's what we've seen in the past. So if you have someone go on your behalf that wants the match with you, so what Savage should have done, instead of begging Tunney, he should have made Jake's life miserable and forced him to go to Tunney and agree. Or the other option, right, is to go to the Ultimate Warrior and say, hey, you know, you're the one that beat me. Can you go to Tunney on my behalf and ask him to lift the stipulation? Because that was who I had the agreement with. So I think there were other paths that Savage could have taken instead of what he did.
But he was also involved at the time. He was all over TV. I think this is the peak Jack Tunney, in a way, or the second rise of Jack Tunney, because he was involved in 88 as well quite a bit. But the whole thing with The Undertaker and Hulk Hogan, Survivor Series with the title, and he went to Tuesday in Texas. Jack Tunney was all over TV with all that. So he was kept quite busy around this time, wasn't he, Parvin? Do you think he was finally earning his wage?
Well, he's all over the place here at this point. It's like, he is being pressed into service an awful lot, but he's got a lot to put up with. I mean, Ric Flair's running around. Jake is, you know, causing havoc, takers around. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, Savage is demanding, Hogan is demanding. So he's got a lot of, big characters to try to manage at this point. So you can see why, he was more active than usual.
And I think after this point, we next see him. He's involved again here in 92. There was a press conference for WrestleMania 8 in February the 1st of 92. And Jack Tunney was there with Oakland, and we had Flair, Perfect, Justice, Savage, Undertaker. We're all at this press conference, Roddy Piper as well. And it was Jack Tunney mentioned that each of the possible challenges in attendance could have possibly got a shot, but it was actually the end of the day. Tunney then named Hogan as the challenger to face Flair at WrestleMania 8, and then Justice was visibly upset and walked off. And after that, Sean Mooney interviewing Savage at the press conference, said he wanted a shot, but he wished Hogan well. And then Mooney interviewed Justice, who blamed Hogan for not winning the Royal Rumble and argued Tunney's decision. And Justice then said that Hogan couldn't beat Flair on his best day, but Sid could. So I think Sid had a case here, really, guys, JT. I mean, Hogan got eliminated third to last, and then it was Sid second to last. So I think boo-hoo, and we're siding with Hogan here.
Yeah, Tunney... He was in a weird spot because he was kind of siding with some of the heels, but I don't know. He kind of looks like maybe he was in Hogan's back pocket here, because you go into Survivor Series and yeah, there's some chicanery that leads to Undertaker winning the title. Hogan politics his way into an immediate rematch at Tuesday in Texas. Tunney's at ringside. He gets knocked down. Hogan cheats. So Tunney says, all right, well, I'll be fair here. You know, so Hogan's kind of had his chances now. He's had two shots at Undertaker, couldn't beat him clean. We go to the Rumble, where Hogan was eliminated very cleanly. I mean, Sid was in the match. He threw him out. Hogan cheated. And then Tunney chooses Hogan for no reason to be the number one contender for WrestleMania 8. I mean, there's zero reason why Sid wasn't the contender. He was the last man in there with Flair, not Hogan. And Sid was illegally eliminated by Hogan, who had already been thrown out. So I don't understand the kowtowing to Hogan here when... I mean, Hogan was completely in the wrong during this time period. And the fans were letting them hear it. They were not happy with Hogan.
Well, I don't know. It was obviously not designed to get that to happen. But, I mean, with just to Justice on Saturday night's main event in February, that was the one that was aired on Fox, he came out and claimed that Jack Tunney was showing favoritism towards Hogan. So we saw this because it was evident from Royal Rumble 92, where Hogan went out third to last, as we said. And then, you know, it's evident that Sid Justice has got a point, and he's mentioned in this. So it's obvious to the fans out there that Sid Justice is someone that we should be rooting for and who's been unjust. So I don't understand how Vince saw this as a way to kind of keep Hogan as a face and shared by the fans. Parv, I mean, do you think there's any madness, you know, reason to this madness?
I can't think of anything, really.
Or method to the madness.
It makes no sense, unless they were trying to make a pun on Sid Justice's name, that the man wants justice. That's the only thing I can think of that makes any sense. So, pun-based booking, I don't know.
he's not having a good real, you know, run of things there, Tony, I think. And like we said before, he's struggling with some of his decisions. But he's still around in 92, isn't he? He's involved with the whole Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage thing in the summer months, where he's trying to get them to kind of not fight. Jack Tunney selected them to wrestle the Nasty Boys as well. Do you remember that match?
I don't. JT might.
Yeah, it was a good match.
I remember that.
It was an interesting match because the basically they had on one side, didn't they, JT? You had Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect beating on Savage, and on the other side, the Nasty Boys beating on the Warrior, and it was quite a long beatdown of two faces, I thought.
Yeah, that was the SummerSlam Spectacular, right? To tease the, or is that the? I know they have one at SummerSlam, one at Survivor Series Spectacular. I think Survivor Series was the.
That was SummerSlam. This one, yeah.
Okay, I think they fought Money Inc. at the or Mayo Saturday's main event. I know they had one with Money Inc. as well, but.
I've never seen that car, that SummerSlam Spectacular 92.
Yeah, it's not a bad show. And that match was interesting.
Is that in London?
It was pre-taped. It was a week before.
Right.
But yeah, that was an interesting beatdown. And again, Tunney was trying to keep them apart, so he makes them team up and ends up costing them both. They get worked over. And Tunney, I mean, completely outclassed by Flair and Perfect during that whole build. He wanted to have this clean matchup between these two guys, but instead they have Flair and Perfect out there messing around with everyone's plans and ruining his big main event in London.
So the next time really where of any major note anyway where we see him on screen is the contract signing before WrestleMania 9 between Bret Hart and Yokozuna. And wherever contract signings happen, there's always some sort of angle out of it. So Tunney's there to witness Yokozuna injuring Bret Hart, Banzai dropping him, and showing his dominance. And there wasn't really much done about that by Tunney, was there? He let that one slide.
The only thing to note there is that I believe that happened on Challenge. And I can never understand why that happened on Challenge, that whole deal.
We had Superstars and Raw, like we touched on, as the A and A minus show, so to speak.
Straight, that's one of the most major things that ever happened on Challenge, that contract signing.
I feel like they gave Challenge a bit of a boost in that spring of 93. I remember them hyping a big, I don't know if you remember this match, Parv, High Energy and Money Inc. tag team title match in the spring of 93, and that was on Challenge.
Good match.
So I think they were... I think they were trying to give Challenge a boost. I don't know if they were trying because it was Bobby wasn't on Superstars anymore, right? Or I don't know if he ever was, but it was Vince and Lawler at this point, I think, and then Bobby and Gorilla were the Challenge crew. So I don't know if they were trying to like reinvigorate that this is like the Gorilla and Bobby hour, and they were trying to add a little, you know, they really re-overhauled all their shows in '93. Well, they brought on Raw, they brought on Mania.
I guess since Primetime had gone, that was the major vehicle for Bobby and Gorilla now. Challenge.
Right, so that might have been part of it, that they tried to kind of refocus Bobby Gorilla and make the shows just as important.
Okay, well, so what else?
Well, what else after that, though? So the next thing really was Jack Tunney officially recognized Hulk Hogan as the new WWF champion. He came out after WrestleMania 9 saying there was a verbal contract.
Hold on, Alan. There is one very important thing at WrestleMania 9 that he does, which is he makes an on-the-spur-of-the-moment decision to tell Money Inc. to get back down the aisle. He says if they get counted out, they lose the belts, which disgusted me as a kid. So just another example of Hogan cronyism from him.
Yeah, well, that's a good example there, screwing over Money Inc. and making them go back. But yeah, he officially recognised Hogan as the champion after WrestleMania 9, which you'd expect, saying there was a verbal contract and that the decision would stand despite the protests of Yokozuna and Mr. Fuji. So after this point, we went back to Detective Jack Tunney. If you remember when we last covered him, he went on the hunt, didn't he, for Matilda, the dog that got kidnapped by the Islanders. He went on, it felt like a 6-month hunt till he decided what he was doing there. So on this occasion, he was actually went to investigate Lex Luger's forearm, which had been surgically repaired, hadn't it, following a motorcycle accident, and he was knocking out people left, right, and centre. So Jack Tunney was on the case there, going to investigate it. So that played out over the course of the end of April. So what he did in the end, he ruled that he could do nothing about the plate in the arm, and tough luck, people have to deal with it. Was at the end of the day, because it was surgically implanted into him from an injury. It wasn't done for an advantage as such. So do you think that was a fair decision for Tunney, or did you think he should have made Lex Luger at least wear some sort of padding over it?
Well, JT, what's your take on this? It seems fair enough to me, but...
Yeah, I mean, it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of his body. Like you said, what are you going to do? I mean, it's not like he had it implanted just to do damage in wrestling. I mean, he didn't put it in. He had a legitimate reason. Doctor's notes. He had surgery. So it's, you know, he had it prior to coming to the company. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess there was precedent earlier in the year with Beefcake where they made him wear the mask. So I guess he could look back to that if he wanted to do something about it. But I can't blame him for this. I mean, there's no real proof.
Some interesting thing though about the forearm though, letting on how so Tunney's such a kind of goes one way than another. So he agreed to give Lex Luger a title shot against Yokozuna at SummerSlam after the whole slam and this, that and the other on the USS Intrepid and the whole Lex Express. But he gave the added stipulation that Luger must wear a protective pad on his forearm. So
see, now there's a big difference because Jim Cornette, one of the biggest lobbyists in wrestling, lobbied the presidency to say, yeah, we'll give him the title match, but he has to wear this protective pad. So Tunney was forced to cave to Cornette. You know, Luger had to agree to it so he could get the title match. So Cornette went to lobby on behalf of the world champion. And that was the importance. That was one of the biggest things Cornette did when Yokozuna brought him in, was to get him to talk about that language and all the contracts that Fuji couldn't handle.
And do you remember around this time, just after SummerSlam, he was a guest on the King's Court, Parv?
I don't. No, I don't remember him on the King's Court. I haven't seen this segment. Have you guys?
I've not seen it. I don't know about you, JT.
I don't recall it, no. Like, I have a vague memory of seeing him there, but I don't remember the actual segment at all.
Obviously, it wasn't that noteworthy.
This is getting into a kind of strange period for Tunney where, like, I feel like around this time you kind of see him more sparingly. Like he's super active in late 91, like we talked about. And around this time he kind of slips away a bit more. Would you agree with that, JT? Like, you only see him once in a while now.
Yeah, he had these weird spurts where he'd come in and then disappear and then come in and disappear. And he was, like you said, I mean, he was really all over the place in late 91 and into 92, like all of a sudden out of nowhere, very, very active. And now we see him sporadically in 93 and early 94. And then from there on out, it's very, very vague appearances. But 93 pops up more than you would think, just not as much as 91 and 92.
Yeah, because he's threatening to ban Lawler for life if he doesn't go back and face Bret Hart at SummerSlam 93. Right. He strips Shawn Michaels of the IC title and put it in a 20-man battle royal. To see who would win.
Fair.
And then what he did as well is there was Shawn Michaels was trying to get his suspension lifted, and there was like a call-in vote to one of the TV shows. I don't know if it was Raw or Superstars, with 36% voting yes and 64% voting no. So he was trying to petition there. I mean, nothing really came out of that from Tunney's decision at the time. Doink announced later on, a month later, that WWF President Jack Tunney ruled that there could only be one Doink. So what Doink decided to do was introduce Dink instead. So on the technicality, so Tunney tied things up.
I didn't know about that rule that he made up, there can be no second Doink rule. Did you know about that, JT?
Yeah, the Doinks are running rampant throughout 93. They had really fucked with Crush all through the spring. Crush was probably pissed off that the Doinks weren't there to help, you know, that Tunney wasn't there to bail him out. Doinks made his life hell for 6 months. And then the straw that broke the camel's back was Survivor Series, when you had the four Doinks played by Men on a Mission and the Bushwhackers. And Tunney said, finally, this is enough. It's out of hand. All these Doinks running around my company. So that's where he said no more. And then Santa Claus showed up to deliver Dink as a present to Doink.
So the next kind of decision, really, where he's in two minds about something and what to do, is at the Royal Rumble in 94, where it was the co-winners Bret and Lex. If you remember, we touched on the Royal Rumble 94 in the previous episode. So he appeared to listen to both sides of the argument, to who touched the floor first. And then Tunney spoke to Howard Finkel, who, after quite a lot of hesitation between the two, announced that both men were the winners. So Tunney at the time, I think probably the right thing to do, he was under pressure, we couldn't really choose one over another, so he went with both. And do you think that was a good decision, JT?
I think it made him look soft. I mean, it's like, make you there, now you're dragging out the end of this match by 15 minutes, you can't decide what's going on. It's just, yeah, I thought it made him look real bad. It doesn't shock me that he was only around for a brief time more after this, because you could tell it was starting to slip for him.
I feel like Luger didn't have Tunney in the pocket like Hogan did, because if this was Hogan, I reckon he would have won.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, Luger. Yeah, he wasn't as much supported by Tunney as you would have. He would have probably assumed or hoped. So what Tunney decided was there would be two WWF World Title matches at WrestleMania 10, and that a coin flip would be held on Raw to see who would get the first shot between Luger and Bret Hart. So as we know, that Luger got the first shot there against Yokozuna, and Bret had to face Owen. But the next time we see him was at WrestleMania 10, where Bill Clinton was shown in the crowd, and that was the impersonator Bill Clinton, who looked quite like Bill Clinton, who was the president at the time, and he was there with Bill Clinton IRS, and it was them two and Jack Tunney watching the proceedings at WrestleMania 10, Parv. So did you like Jack Tunney spending some time with IRS?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. So, you know, probably he was being audited, made sure all his affairs were in order. although if we know anything about the real life Jack Tunney, I don't know how good a job IRS was doing there, because it may actually, maybe that led directly to his demise. Because Jack Tunney was indeed on the take, as we were about to find out.
Definitely, with Jack Tunney being like that. So this was really fading out here, isn't it, Parv? We've only got a couple more things kind of that he did of note. Is there anything else that really stood out for you before we kind of see what his last appearance was?
Not really. I mean, he really, at this point in 94, he's basically done. I don't believe you see him again, really, Jack Tunney. I was trying to hunt down what the last appearance was, and we were talking for ages, weren't we, JT? We were like a few months ago, really trying to find when it was. And
they talk about him a lot, they reference him, but yeah, I don't remember him actually being on really again before he's gone.
The last time I can see, well, the appearance he quickly had, he did one of these kind of official appearances that was an official one, where it was the retirement show of who was it now? Montreal Forum, Rougeau. Jack Rougeau's retirement show at the time. So there was like Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson, Jack Tunney, Billy Red Lions, Killer Kowalski, Jack Rougeau Senior, and people of that nature. So it was people from around the Montreal area, famous for it at the time. So he obviously was Canadian, so he was involved in that. So the last time we actually saw him on TV was on pay per view or TV was In Your House One, where Jerry Lawler was in a heated discussion with Jack Tunney about a match with Bret Hart. So that was the last time we saw him on TV, and then it was announced in July in a match between Bob Holly and Mike Bell that during the match it was just quietly announced that Jack Tunney announced his retirement the previous Wednesday, and that was the last we heard of him.
And of course what had happened in real life is that Jack Tunney had been found that for years he'd been kind of skimming from the Montreal office, and that is the reason that the real life Jack Tunney kind of stopped doing the gig. That's what happened in real life. But on screen, they just announced this very quietly. And the next week, Gorilla Monsoon is appointed the new president. And I actually went and tracked down his first appearance. And he makes like a slew of new rulings then, and maybe on a future edition. And then we can look at the tenure of Gorilla Monsoon.
Yeah, definitely, from being squashed by Vader and things like that. They pushed him as having some new ideas and things like that on screen, so it'll be quite interesting to discuss that. So,
and he said too that he was going to listen to the fans. That was like his big thing. If you remember, his first big ruling was taking Sid out of the SummerSlam IC title match and making it the ladder rematch to placate the fans. So that was a kind of, you know, it was almost like a dig at Tunney one last time. Like, I'm going to be different. I'm not going to be governed by money and rules. I'm going to listen to the fans. So,
all right. Well, that is the end of Jack Tunney in terms of in storyline. But do any of you chaps know what happened in real life for Jack Tunney to leave? Do you know why he left? JR?
I think the corruption has caught up to him, and they finally ran him out of office. That would do it, I think. But I think it had something to do with really about the Toronto territory, right? I know he was in charge of promoting up there and booking the shows for them, and well, not booking per se, but booking the arenas and promoting locally. But and I thought by 95, they pretty much were phasing that out. Was it contractually related, Parv, or is there more to it?
Well, I mean, the Toronto office and the WWF office had a long-term relationship going all the way back to the days of Bruno Sammartino in the 60s. Bruno would go up there. They'd exchange talent quite a lot. People like Ivan Koloff, like he'd have a run in Toronto and then he'd have a run in New York. And the Tunneys and the McMahons were always close. I guess Irish stock, eh? Something like that. And
Basically, what happened is that when Vince was making all of his moves in around 83, 84, he cut a deal with the Tunnies that essentially during the expansion, they would run most of the operation north of the border in Canada. But a pivotal part of that deal was that the Tunnies had an exclusive had exclusive rights to run the Maple Leaf Gardens, which is a really interesting venue to look back on, because Crockett used to you have these weird cards in the early 80s which have got WWF and Crockett talent mixed with like local Canadian jobbers and things. But anyway, even at this late point, the only reason that Vince was allowed to run Maple Leaf Gardens was because of Jack Tunney. And he had actually had like a little crew up there. Alan, do you know anything about this
kind of Canadian mafia up there? The Canadian mafia. I do remember the venue itself because it had the raised entranceway. There was quite a few matches that came out on the Bret Hart release last year, the kind of hidden dungeon matches. And I think there was a match with Perfect that came from the Maple Leaf Garden. And yeah, I mean, Toronto itself is an interesting territory, like you're saying, Parv. There's a lot of guys went through there, so they weren't affiliated completely with the WWF, were they? They had guys flowing in from all over, which made it quite interesting, you know, at the time. So Tunney had, you know, he had the kind of contract. So you were saying that he had the contract. So how did Vince then kind of phase him out of getting that?
Well, what happened is that, as I said before, Jack on the take Tunney actually was on the take. It emerged that he had been siphoning off the gates of Maple Leaf Gardens and various other things for years and years and years. And that Jack Tunney, Kevin Nash has talked about this in various different shoot interviews, that every time he'd turn up, he'd have a brand new Cadillac, or, you know, he was actually loaded. Jack Tunney was. He constantly was turning up with, like, he'd have a new, like, you know, really flash suits and things like this. And it was because they had been ripping off the office for years and years. And obviously Vince was trying to, you know, get, like, he was in 94, 95, really trying to cut costs wherever he could. And once these details emerged that Jack Tunney had been on the take, as it were, I think people had kind of like known for years, but turned a blind eye because it was convenient. But now Vince was actually, you know, as we talked about before, running kind of much smaller loops and actually going back to the core territory a bit. And they even decided that maybe they didn't even want to run Maple Leaf for a while. So basically they, you know, Tunney was sacked for being crooked.
Well, there we go then. That's like Heenan and Ventura, right? All these years, weren't they, saying that he's on the take? No one listening. Gorilla Monsoon shot them both down, telling them, will he stop? And, you know, in the end of the day, they were correct.
So just, I think we've talked about Tunney an awful lot. Just before we wrap up here, any final thoughts, Alan? We've been on a very long journey with Jack Tunney. Any last thoughts on the long-term president?
Well, I'm glad he got his weight under control, firstly. You know, he was a very large man in the early 80s, as you like to point out, Parv. And all in all, he was an interesting president. He was really devoid of a lot of charisma, but I think that was his charm, and I think that was the kind of what you'd expect from a presidential guy. You don't want someone who you want to see all the time. When Jack Tunney turns up, it's, you know, not, you know, every week. It's not like it is nowadays where the figurehead of the promotion or whoever is running Raw or SmackDown's there every week. Jack Tunney, like we've discussed going through his years, he seldom made, you know, appearances two or three shows in a row, and when he did, it was for something important.
JT, any thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, he portrayed the president role well. Like, he came off as legitimate, as serious, even though they kind of treated him goofy sometimes with the way they talk about him when he'd show up. But I thought the look of him and the way he would deliver the announcements, it felt like a big deal when he showed up. I think there were times where he got watered down a bit, like where they'd overuse him during those stretches, especially in late 91 into early 92. But at all times, he still always came across as the president. It never felt like he was over his skis, or he didn't seem like he didn't fit the role. I thought he was perfectly fine. I think the time that he went away was fitting. Like, it made sense by that point to just get rid of him as president and start to have somebody a little bit more active, at least on screen, or well known to a new generation. I mean, we all knew Tunney just by that role, but having a guy like Gorilla take over for him worked, because we all grew up with Gorilla, and he was much more hands-on and active within the product, so it made it seem like a much more, like they did, like the fan-friendly president, or someone that was more in tune with what was going on in the company, versus Tunney, who by the end seemed like he was just out in the ivory tower. He'd come in, you know, he almost started to feel like a puppet toward the end, even to in a kayfabe sense. So I thought having Gorilla come on, and he felt like a much stronger hands-on president.
Yeah, I mean, my thought is that, I mean, you could talk about charisma, but there's lack of charisma, and then there's, like, have you ever seen, like, Jim Crockett Jr. on the mic? Yeah. I mean, he was a charisma void, like, complete vacuum, you know? And I think that Tunney carried a lot more authority than somebody like that. So I think he was really good at, you know, making those official proclamations. I mean, one thing that we haven't mentioned is how bloody wordy he was. He was so good at the legalese, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. Like, nonetheless, never, like, he was very good at adding, like, these kind of official clauses and things like that. So,
I mean, for a very fake thing, you know, like he came across as believable in the role. I think that was the most important thing. Like, for a completely made-up figurehead on-screen president, like, he came off at least as an official of the company. So even if you kind of always suspected maybe he wasn't really the one making the decisions, he always at least came across as a member of the team that made the decisions. So he didn't feel like he was completely, you know, fake, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and just fine, very last thing before we close the book on this topic. I mean, one of the tropes of the past, God knows how, I mean, how long has it been now? 20 years has been the heel authority figure.
Oh, yeah.
Like, literally since Eric Bischoff and Vince back in the Attitude Era. Do you think there's any chance of a Tunney-like figure making a comeback? I mean, is William Regal a bit like that in NXT, Alan?
To a degree, he's a bit more of an official character, and he doesn't show up on every show, and it's only for important decisions, so his face isn't all over the show. So there's elements of it there, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon, but never say never. I think, you know, 10 years down the line, and I know that's a scary thought, but when Vince finally gives up the reins a little bit, I think we will see change, and that's going to be one of the major things we probably will see.
All right, well, let's move on to our very last segment now. It's been quite a packed show this week, but we do have a little bit of time left for the WWF Magazine Corner.
The new World Wrestling Federation magazine is now on sale. All this and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine, on sale this Tuesday at your local newsstand.
And I believe this is connected to a listener question this week, Alan.
Yes, it is, and let me just get this one out the sack. So this is, Dear Alan and Parv, as I've told you before, my favourite wrestler is Dino Bravo. And there's always been him. I'd like you to discuss Dino Bravo's new strategy from WWF Magazine, May 1988, page 44, and that's from Chadley Crisolo in Newark, Connecticut. So hang on a minute, Chadley. Weren't we saying that Ludwig Borger was your favourite? But you're now telling me that it's Dino Bravo. I'm really confused, but we'll go with it anyway, Chadley. We'll answer your question. So what's this article about then, Parv?
Well, it's good to see a bit of consistency from Chadley there. Well, this article is called Dino Bravo's New Strategy. and it's called Strength Rules by Lou Gianfrido.
I'd argue Dino, his strategy is finding someone he could latch onto, but go ahead.
Dino Bravo has shocked the sports world. Bodybuilders are envious. Powerlifters amazed. And a lot of his potential opponents in the World Wrestling Federation are worried. Bravo, during January's WWF television special, originating from the Hamilton, Ontario Cops Coliseum and aired over the USA, network, defied the odds by breaking the world bench press record of 705 pounds. The burly Canadian heaved a total of 715 pounds off his muscular chest. Bravo's achievement, which was not without controversy, has made him more arrogant and dangerous than ever. His tactics, always roughhouse and seldom clean, now rely totally on overpowering opponents by sheer strength and brutality. And Bravo is quoted here. He says, "I will rule the WWF with my strength," says Bravo through a translator, because he refuses to speak English, only French. That he is immensely strong, there is no doubt, but how strong? As he prepared for his record-breaking lift, Bravo began warming up with 455 pounds, which only a few decades ago was a world class, was the world record class. After banging out a few repetitions, he worked up in weight. WWF commentator Jesse the Body Ventura, no stranger to pumping iron, spotted Bravo as a safety measure and also to give him encouragement. And then basically it kind of goes through the details of this angle, which I'm sure you're both familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
Frenchie Martin was obviously in attendance as well. Any thoughts on this? I mean, basically this article goes on. He says Bravo's ring technique depends heavily on choking, punishing and kicking an opponent until he is groggy. Then Bravo mixes it up scientifically only to go back to the dirty stuff. That's what it says here. So a little bit of psychology talk. Any memories of Bravo weightlifting, JT?
The main thing I remember is Jesse Ventura defending what happened by saying he just had the two pinkies worth of pressure on the bar and the rest was all Dino Bravo. I mean, he rode that thing forever. It was years worth of that storyline being utilized and talked about during each and every Dino Bravo match. So he obviously went to all these announcers and beat it into them and threatened them to discuss this weightlifting prowess and this strength prowess to help get him over so he could get bigger matches and more paychecks. Now, did it show results in the ring? Here and there, it was spotty. But I'll give this to Bravo. Anytime it seemed like maybe he was sputtering, he found a new hook, right? So he found the new dream team, and then he did this weightlifting power stuff with Frenchie Martin, and then he found the earthquake and hung on to him for a while. So there was always something that he was able to find and latch his way into to hang around for probably much longer than he normally would have if he was just left on his own devices.
Now, there's a bit of intrigue at the end of this article here. It says, as for ego, Bravo's is as puffed up as his muscles. Proclaiming himself Canada's strongest man, he feels he is superior to all Canadian athletes and far above anything the United States can produce. His arrogant attitude has earned him even more detractors, including fellow French Canadians, the Rougeau brothers, Jacques and Raymond. So this is Jacques now. He says, sure, he's a good athlete and very powerful. He's dangerous to be up against, but there are plenty of other great athletes in Canada and the US. The way he acts, so arrogant, he disgraces Quebec. Isn't that right, Ray? Yes, says Raymond emphatically. He's a good wrestler, as my brother said, but he's not a good person. He treats people as if they are below him. We speak both French and English, depending on who we're talking to. If you can talk a person's language, why not use it? Bravo and Frenchie were asked about the Rougeau's comments. Punks, snorts Frenchie. Why should Bravo and me lower ourselves by speaking English? If you can't understand what we say, learn French if you're smart enough, says Bravo. However, at least one fellow Canadian in the WWF admires Bravo. He is Bret Hart of the Hart Foundation. And this is Bret. He says, Dino Bravo is a credit to sports. Look at his record. I'm honored to know the man. He's my kind of wrestler. Not afraid to do what he has to do when he needs it. What I need, says Bravo, is a WWF title. So, Alan, any thoughts about this?
Well, Bravo is, I mean, he might be Chadley's favourite, but I've never, ever been a fan of Dino Bravo. I think we've touched on this on a previous episode, Parv. I thought he sucked in the ring. I can't remember one memorable match that he was in particularly. There's a few angles and moments like this one, you know, with the wet bench press. And this match itself, though, or this kind of angle, this was at the Royal Rumble, wasn't it, in 88?
Yes.
This happened at Royal Rumble, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, people can check that out. It's just him, and it's obvious that, you know, the angles to put over the Jesse Ventura's really helping him, but Dino Bravo's saying he's not, and, you know, it goes from there. So, yeah, Dino Bravo is not really anyone that's my favourite, unfortunately, Chadley. So I'm going to call time on Dino Bravo this episode, and I'm hoping that we don't have any more Dino Bravo speak. So, Chadley, you're going to have to either like that or lump that, unfortunately, my friend, but this is going to be a Dino Bravo free zone. Cascase.
Censored. all right, well, I think we're out of time now, chaps. So I think we've just got enough time to give us the Twitter handles. So JT, if people want to get hold of you, how can they go about it?
You can find me running the Place to Be Nation Twitter account at Place Number 2 Be Nation.
Alan?
You can find me at Alan_Cheapshot. And yourself, Parv?
I'm at Jerry Von K. And if you want to send something into the mailbag, tag us both and say like mail or sack or something, and it will help us find it.
Bulging sack.
Big old sack of letters.
Yeah.
After consulting with the personal physician of the Macho Man, Randy Savage, I cannot in good conscience allow Randy Savage to participate in the Survivor Series. With the tragic events of this past weekend still fresh in all our minds, I accept full responsibility for allowing such a potentially dangerous reptile at ringside. I will accept Jake Roberts' explanation at face value that this was indeed an accident, and that he had been led to believe that his King Cobra had indeed been devenomized by the lab. However, resting upon my shoulders is the welfare of everyone here in the World Wrestling Federation. Therefore, effective immediately, the King Cobra and all reptiles are barred from ringside. In addition, after careful consultation with the Macho Man Randy Savage and his doctor, it is my decision that he be reinstated immediately, and that a match between Randy Savage and Jake Roberts be sanctioned at the earliest possible date, which will be this coming Tuesday night in Texas.
Finally, reinstatement for the Macho Man, Randy Savage. He will face Jake the Snake Roberts this Tuesday in Texas. All kinds of controversy still surrounding the big championship title change at Survivor Series. Jack Tunney had this to say to Mean Gene Okerlund about that.
Never in my life have I seen anything quite so disgusting, quite so despicable. As a matter of fact, President Jack Tunney, it's a travesty, and I want to know what you're going to do about it.
Gene, notwithstanding what actually occurred here this evening in the Gravest Challenge, the referee's decision is final.
That's...
and cannot be challenged by me. However, it is well within my authority to order a rematch at the earliest possible date. Therefore, it is my decision that The Undertaker meet Hulk Hogan in a rematch for the World Wrestling Federation title this Tuesday in Texas.
Amen.
And furthermore, I will physically be at ringside to ensure a fair and just outcome.